You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of July 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On the programme today,
Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
As Theresa May prepares to move into 10 Downing Street tomorrow afternoon, we'll ask how the rest of Europe is likely to react to Britain's new Prime Minister. Plus, if Beijing is so furious as the tribunal's ruling on the South China Sea, can it simply ignore it? Well, apparently yes. So what does this mean for international justice? And former Australian Prime Minister Bob Hawke says that for the first time since the Second World War, there are no outstanding leaders in the world. Is he right? That's all coming up on Midori House, live from London, with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are the journalist and broadcaster Michael Goldfarb and Matthew Green, former FT correspondent in West Africa, Pakistan and Afghanistan. Welcome to you both. We're going to begin with something a little bit different from what I said at the top, which is that in the last few moments, Bernie Sanders has finally given his endorsement to Hillary Clinton, ending his campaign and making way for a unified Democratic bid for the White House. Michael Goldfarb, this was always going to happen. It's not a shock that it's happened, but it's certainly a bit of a boost for Hillary Clinton that it's happened now.
It is, and it comes at a really good time, because, I mean, she's been slightly adrift the last fortnight. The never-ending saga of the actually not very substantial questions about her emails and whether they might have contributed to the death of four U.S. Diplomats and soldiers in Benghazi years ago just won't let her go because of the way she is, and the fact that Bernie was still out there on the side, not yet endorsing her, because he was using his moment of leverage to make sure that the Democratic Party platform reflected in considerable degree a much more liberal and progressive view than it might have otherwise if she had been unopposed. He got what he wanted, and we'll find the details out when they finally have the convention in week after next. But, you know, it's good for her, and it's actually good for the party, for the two of them to do what, as you said, Steve, was always going to happen. They were going to share a platform. He was going to endorse her. But it's a good bit of timing now, and they'll seize the news cycle a bit in a positive way for a day or two, because the Republicans have their convention next week, and that's going to be brutal and ugly.
Well, we will be discussing how brutal and how ugly on lots more shows in the days to come. But Matt Green, looking at the Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton deal, as it were, or the sort of the moment of unity, this is always going to be slightly different from 8 years ago, when Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama actually went to a place called Unity to give their big rally, where she finally came out in support of him. It was always going to be slightly lower key this time around. The key question, I guess, is whether all those people that backed Bernie Sanders are going to be willing to back Hillary Clinton, and I guess more importantly, because most of them frankly will, how vigorously they'll be willing to do it.
Well, I think we can only pray that they will, won't we? I mean, obviously the spectre of Donald Trump is what hangs over this whole conversation, and I think for most people watching around the world, like you say, the finer points of these emails pales in comparison to the fear that the idea of a Trump presidency evokes. So we can only greet the news today with relief and hope that, like you say, that all those Bernie Sanders supporters rally vigorously to Clinton's flag.
The other thing is that, you know, in the American system, as we've learned to our cost these last 8 years, when the Republican Congress has been able to subvert every single attempt at legislation that President Obama has put forward, almost, you know, Bernie going out and putting his forces to work trying to elect certainly a Democratic Senate and, you know, to kind of whittle back the gerrymandered Republican majority in the House of Representatives is hugely important. It's not just about pushing Hillary over the finish line. It's about generating enough commitment from his young, overwhelmingly young supporters to get out there and, you know, vote, but also to convince others to vote for Democrats wherever they can. And that way, at least Hillary can have a fighting chance to push through this much more progressive platform than she might otherwise have run on.
And Matt, it's also important to point out that this therefore means there is a very united Democratic Party with Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, you know, Elizabeth Warren, all their big hitters from across the spectrum will be singing from the same hymn sheet. Whereas we, if you look across the aisle at the Republicans, they've got you know,
it's open warfare. Isn't
yeah,
it?
they have a candidate where the previous candidates, Mitt Romney, John McCain, George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, don't want anything to do with him.
Yeah, and who's done very little in the way of actually assembling a machine, an election-winning machine, to win the ground war, as it were. But, I mean, I'm curious what Michael thinks. Presumably Bernie Sanders as well can appeal, perhaps more than Hillary can, to the disenfranchised white middle-class voters, where Trump has kind of pitched his stall as well, to some extent.
Well, there's this molten middle, and I don't mean middle class, because, I mean, that term has come to have no meaning anymore, really. Mm. There's a molten middle. I was just last month in Ohio, which is a big swing state. It's also the scene of this Republican convention. And there's a great deal of anger, despair, and confusion in that middle. What Bernie can do is, you know, the amazing thing about Bernie Sanders' campaign was a 74-year-old guy, a New York Jewish guy, pulled out this extraordinary, invented out of whole cloth through his authenticity.
And not just a 74-year-old guy, but a socialist.
Well, and a socialist. Let's not, well, I mean, no, there are socialists and socialists. But I mean,
someone who self-identifies
and who's willing to use the word and in one fell swoop detoxify a word that, you know, for 60 years, going back to the time of Joe McCarthy, actually 80 years, going back to the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt, socialism was a toxic word. You couldn't, that's why America's never had a social democratic party. The Democrats under FDR were social Democrats in the European sense, but they couldn't add the S word. And Bernie makes it possible. I think it's important. And I think he can really push. However, there will be this, as I say, it's a molten mass. And there will be, who can put a percentage on? 10-15% who will float right up to the polling booth and you'll never be sure whether they'll vote for Trump or Hillary, or they may not vote at all.
And that's the issue, Matt, isn't it, that we've seen, you know, across the world in the past 4 or 5 years particularly, and, you know, really back to, you know, after the crash in 2008, that there is a group of voters who have been left behind by globalization, who are understandably angry in many cases, and who feel that they have been disenfranchised. And we saw it here with the Brexit vote 2 weeks ago. What was interesting is that these people actually voted, whereas in the past they haven't necessarily. Turnout in the US election, which is always, you know, never really gets above 50%, that could be quite interesting this time.
Yeah, well, that's right. I remember we were sitting in this very studio only a couple of weeks ago on the eve of the referendum when Nigel Farage had just conceded defeat, feeling that this was going to go in favour of Remain. And so many of us were surprised when it went in the other direction. And I think, in a sense, the silver lining from Brexit is that it has forced us to start a new conversation, certainly in Britain, about inequality and the uneven gains from the current global economic order. And that's obviously a conversation that's happening around the world. So at least Brexit has forced us to face up to that.
Well done for trying to find a silver lining in Brexit. we're going to move on to Britain and its relationship with Europe now. Tomorrow, Britain will get a new Prime Minister. David Cameron held his final cabinet meeting today. He'll have his final promises questions tomorrow at 12 noon. Then he'll head off to the palace and hand in his resignation to the Queen, because that still happens here. Theresa May will then head to the palace herself. The Queen, one assumes, she'll ask Theresa May to form a government, although she doesn't necessarily have to if she doesn't want to, but let's face it, it's probably going to happen. And then she will become Prime Minister. And Michael Goldfarb, Theresa May, it's worth pointing out, despite the fact that Britain voted to leave the European Union, despite the fact that two-thirds of the Conservative Party voters voted to leave the European Union, Theresa May was for Remain. And yet, partly because all the senior Leave people have either run away or set themselves on fire, she becomes the Remainer who will have to implement Leave. It's not going to be easy, is it?
Well, it's not going to be easy, even if she was for Brexit. I mean, this whole thing is not going to be easy. In a curious way, her soft Remain position, and it was very soft, probably the only softer Remain politician was Jeremy Corbyn, who barely campaigned for it. And that's pretty soft, because he spent his whole career thinking that Britain in the EU was a bad idea. I don't know. I don't think we know her. I mean, the one thing that strikes me is that even the professional political writers in this country, she's just an opaque presence. She's been Home Secretary for 6 years. She was chairman of the Conservative Party. Nobody knows who she is. She went to Oxford at the same time as half the bloody political correspondents in the country. I mean, last night it was very funny. He was in, Michael Crick, who's a senior journalist at Channel 4 News here in Britain, was interviewing Alan Duncan, who was a contemporary at Oxford and a friend of Theresa's. And it got all very chummy, that interview. It was very funny. It was like, well, what did you think of her? At one point, Alan Duncan, a Conservative MP, asked Michael Crick, well, what did you think of her? Because they've known each other, and nobody knows who she is. So I don't know how we can be certain of what she is, except there are statements on the record. And I think that makes her one of the most interesting people around. And I've thought this for several years.
But interesting in a strange way, because as you say, you know, you can look at, you know, the speech which she gave, I want to say 2 days ago, but everything's run so quickly. Yeah. Was it even yesterday?
It was yesterday.
It was yesterday morning, wasn't it?
Yes.
Of course.
Yes.
Things have been going very quickly. Yesterday morning, she gave a speech which, if it had been said in a sort of nasal tone by a man, you'd be like, ah, that's Ed Miliband. It was almost word for word, talking about, let's have workers on boards, let's have, I'm really concerned about the life chances of other people. And yet, Matt Green, if you look at Theresa May's speech from Conservative Party conference a year ago, or less than a year ago, it was quite nasty. It was anti-migrant, it was, you know, seen as anti-foreign. Even The Telegraph, a very right-wing newspaper, criticised it for essentially going too far. Do we know who's about to become Prime Minister?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it was Theresa May who gave the famous speech in 2002 about the Tories having to shed their image as the nasty party. And she's obviously described as someone who is very concerned about the image of the party, and particularly its diversity. And she's worked very hard to promote women as MPs and elsewhere in government. So I think you're right. She's a paradoxical figure, because certainly she's on the right. She's been a very authoritarian Home Secretary in terms of looking for more powers for the police and intelligence agencies to
fight
terrorism.
She sent out those vans which said, you know, if you're an illegal immigrant, go home or you'll be arrested.
That's true. Although I did read a rather sympathetic profile of her in The Guardian a few days ago that said that she was mortified by that, and it wasn't her decision, but
okay,
it was her department.
Yes,
so
exactly.
I don't know. I mean, I think one of the interesting things that's kind of being said about her is that she has a kind of a moral compass as more than an ideological compass. That she's not like Thatcher in the sense of having a very clear agenda, but she's keen to basically do what she thinks is right. And that could make for some very intriguing decisions.
Well, one of the interesting things about her is that, and I certainly don't know her, is, you know, it seems the critical fact is that her father was a vicar, Church of England vicar, and she was brought up in that tradition. And much about her strikes me as being kind of mid-19th century Toryish. That is to say, aware that there are inequities in the society that need to be dealt with. And it's her Christian duty to attend to those who've been left behind. But also that quite stunning lack of conservatives have a lack of curiosity about how that happens and what can be done to remedy it at source, rather than offering, you know, charity from the vicarage, which is what the tradition she grew up in. So, I mean, what does she have in common? Angela Merkel similarly comes from a family where her father was a Lutheran minister, and I mean, perhaps they are conservatives of a similar ilk.
And it's, you know, it would have been really fascinating to have seen how Theresa May, Prime Minister, worked alongside Angela Merkel, Chancellor of Germany, in the European Union. We're not going to see that now. But Merkel and May are going to have something to do with each other, Matt, because, you know, the big thing that she's going to have to deal with over the next 3.5 years, until there's a next election, unless there's one sooner, is how Britain extricates itself from the European Union. And, you know, you look around Europe and a lot of leaders they don't know what Britain wants to do. They don't know what the new Prime Minister wants to do, other than Brexit means Brexit, is what she says. But no one knows what Brexit actually means. How do you think Europe's going to be responding to Britain's new Prime Minister?
Well, I was just thinking as you were talking there, with all the excitement over the new leadership, it's almost like a little reprieve from being so depressed about Brexit, isn't it? It's given us something to talk about and be intrigued by that isn't this absolutely monumental task of somehow untangling ourselves from the EU in anything that approaches a beneficial fashion. Absolutely. I mean, the tragedy of this, isn't it, that it's going to consume so much energy of government, of ministers, of the civil service. It's the work of a lifetime, essentially, isn't it, that has to be compressed down into 2 years. And I mean, May's obviously an ambitious politician, but you almost have to have a kind of slither of sympathy for her, kind of picking up that poison chalice.
Michael, what will Europe want to hear from? And I know I'm using Europe in a sort of slightly homogenous term, but still, what will senior politicians across Europe be wanting to hear from Theresa May in the coming days?
Well, it depends on what part of Europe. I think that's pretty clear. I think, you know, they've already heard something that perhaps scares them, which is Brexit means Brexit. And she probably said that to mollify all those members of the Conservative Party who voted for Brexit, and, you know, she was part of the Remain campaign. But hopefully the leaders in Europe understand when politicians speak to their domestic audiences, because they all do. If you're coming from the Baltic states, Poland, Eastern Europe, former Soviet states, former Soviet bloc states, what you really want is to start hearing a bit more polite tone about immigration. What you want is to have some encouragement from her that things that she's said in the last week about not guaranteeing that people who are here to work in the UK, because they come from Poland and the Baltics, will be allowed to stay or will not be harassed, or that she will speak out strongly against the extraordinary upsurge in xenophobic attacks against, you know, Polish workers and so on. It's just been disgusting. And that's what they'll want to hear. I think that the big two, France and Germany, want to know that they have a focused negotiating partner, because in the end, everything about Europe is decided amongst the big three. Once the UK goes, it'll be decided amongst the big two. And the smaller countries get in line. And, you know, I guess, you know, if you're in the southern tier, what you're really wanting to know is that the pound won't collapse so far that you'll lose your British tourists. Because this is a very important thing. I mean, if the pound gets much weaker, places like Italy and Greece and Spain and Portugal will begin to lose those package tourists, because if a beer is costing you 10 quid when it used to cost you 2 quid, you know, you're just not going to go.
Well, anyone that hasn't booked a holiday, a summer holiday now, and if it's going to be, and of course the big question is, will the sun shine in Britain in July and August? But if the sun shines in July and August and you ain't booked your holiday yet, you're staying here. We're going to move on. We've got two other things I want to talk about for the end of the programme. Leadership and also the South China Sea. Stay tuned.
What is culture with Robert Bound?
This is the show of shows. There was something really magical about it.
Everybody's boozing, having grand adulterous love affairs. There's fabulous fist fights, and everybody is smoking opium.
How did that get in there? Well, we're not enjoying the after party. We're on an intrepid investigation each week to answer questions like, how do you adapt a novel and how do you start an art collection? Culture with Robert Bound is your one-stop shop for the answers to the cultural questions that leave you scratching your head every day. Grab a drink, pull up a chair and tune in every Monday at 1900 London time.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me, Matthew Green and Michael Goldfarb. Beijing's tug of war over the South China Sea has become somewhat monotonous. Every time the international community tries to maintain some kind of legal order, China simply looks the other way. Today's ruling by an international tribunal in The Hague is unlikely to change that situation. The Permanent Court of Arbitration found that China's claims to historic and economic rights in most of the South China Sea have no legal basis. But Beijing's official line has already taken a rebellious tone. They don't recognise the tribunal's jurisdiction. So, Matthew Green, big question. Do international decisions like this actually make any difference at all?
Well, the key part of that question is like this, isn't it? Because it's quite unusual that China would find itself on the receiving end of this kind of judgment. And the reaction so far in Beijing has predictably been howls of protest. And to all intents and purposes, no one in the government seems willing to accept the decision. What that means in terms of military manoeuvres, perhaps, by China, we'll have to watch for the Philippines' response, is unclear. But certainly this is an unusual challenge for international law to face.
Michael Goldfarb, the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague doesn't, as far as I'm aware, have any armed forces.
No
police force. So, you know, it's one thing for the... You know, these things only work if people... If nations are willing to accept their, you know, their rights, their responsibilities.
Their responsibilities. Well, one, all men are created equal. All nations aren't. And, you know, when I was talking a few minutes ago about the big three in Europe, they kind of make the decision, and then people kind of come along with it because this is the reality. China signed this agreement, but, you know, throughout the Cold War, there were agreements and they were very often breached, and it became a question of head-to-head diplomacy between the Soviet Union and the United States on any given question. And my guess is that it's a good legal marker to have down. You can say, well, the International Court of Arbitration said this. And if China gets overly aggressive in its interventions with Philippine fishing boats, for example, which has been going on for quite a while, that's why the Philippines brought this charge. I mean, is the Philippines going to go to war with China? Well, no. Will the United States go to war on behalf of the Philippines? Well, no. Not likely, unless there were a huge range of other changes going on as well. So what you have is China will be cosmetically belligerent, is my guess, over the next bit. I mean, Li Jinping has lost face in this judgment. You know, Chinese kids learn that the South China Sea is theirs going back 2,000 years, and they have to row back from this. But this is, you know, an internal policy of promoting nationalism as they try to move away from Maoism, and these things will happen.
And one suspects that those textbooks in Chinese schools aren't going to be changing anytime soon. Okay, let's move on to our final story of the day. A funeral was held in Paris last week for the former French Prime Minister Michel Rocard. For former Australian Prime Minister Bob Hawke, it held a particular resonance. He and Rocard had spent an afternoon together in 1989 setting out a plan to halt an international convention that would have opened up Antarctica to mining and drilling. It was a moment of proactive, optimistic politics stretching beyond international borders, the kind that, according to Hawke, simply wouldn't be possible today. Speaking to the Sydney Morning Herald, he said that for the first time since the Second World War, there is not one outstanding leader in the world. Matt Green, is he right? Or is he being a little bit unfair to Angela Merkel, perhaps, or Barack Obama?
Or self-aggrandising, well, one could argue.
It's Bob Hawke.
he does say, I don't want to blow my own trumpet.
but, yes.
There is a but, yeah.
I mean, obviously what they achieved with the Antarctic was amazing, and what one immediately thinks of the environmental challenges we're facing today, global warming, top of that list. Cristiana Figueres, the UN climate negotiator, managed to bring together all these countries from the wreckage of the Copenhagen summit to the Paris Accord 5 years down the line. I mean, whether or not Paris is going to save us is another question, but at least we got some kind of concerted action. So maybe she deserves a place on that list.
Michael Goldfarb?
There's a part of me that agrees, but there's also a part of me that says you miss the meaning of this moment if you think that there's anyone who can see a way through and help lead in a Moses-like way what used to be called the West to a place of renewed understanding of democracy and how to make capitalism work for more people than it does and all that. I mean, it's just too complicated now. And I'm not sure. I mean, we're in that phase. We're just in a phase where things are so unclear. I do worry, and I think that, you know, coming back to talking about Brexit and so on, Brexit only happens because of inept leadership, because of a lack of courage on the part of David Cameron in calling the referendum in the first place. There's something that Bob Hawke has touched on. On the other hand, if you get handed if the gods give you a good hand to play when you're at the height of your power, like, oh, say the Soviet Union collapses, and you can remake the world in a lot of positive ways, then you can say, well, they were great leaders. They had a vision. They saw that you could unify Europe. We could go to war. We could go and intervene and take dictators off the throats of their people. You know, so...
Is there an issue here, Matt, that we... You know, that there's a sort of a selective memory thing going on, that we, you know, remember the best parts of our history. We remember the heroes and not necessarily sort of the mediocre nonentities.
Yeah, and that's why in Britain we're still obsessed by Winston Churchill, aren't we? I mean, how many times do you... I don't have you down as much of a Daily Mail reader, Steve, but if you do ever pick it up, you'll often find a story about Winston Churchill, won't you? I mean, he looms so large in our national consciousness precisely because he is one of those archetypal figures who embodies courage, or our idea of courage, of grit, of determination. And I suppose it's a question of where we see those sorts of values reflected. I mean, I was pondering the question earlier, and Angela Merkel, we spoke about earlier, she did take that stand on refugees, didn't she? Allowing 800,000 people into the country in the teeth of very fierce opposition in Germany.
Yeah, but then here's the thing, you know, let's look, before Merkel, there was Gerhard Schroeder. No one's going to remember him as a great leader. Before Churchill, there was Neville Chamberlain. He's certainly not remembered as a great leader. After Churchill, the second time, there was Anthony Eden. Again, not someone that's going to be remembered in a good way. Michael, do we just tend to sort of, we pick out the good people and we sort of forget the people that sort of were, so-so?
Well, I mean, people do get forgotten, although, you know, people also remember Richard Nixon. So there you go. You know, we can never forget him in America. I just think that it really comes down to what moment in history brings us to.
Okay, on that point, we'll end. Michael Goldfarb, Matthew Green, thank you both very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Ben Ryland. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Patrick Hun. The studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. There's music next, then it's Culture with Robert Bound. Do stay tuned for that. Midori House back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London. That's 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Have a wonderful day. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.